Human Enterprise is a conversation with leaders, entrepreneurs, investors, and ordinary people about what makes work meaningful, what makes work work, and how to drive the best performance from the people that make up the enterprise. We talk about how to create business value through culture, leaderships, digital innovation, and the employee experience. What are those unmistakably human touches that make an enterprise great, and what can we learn from them? My guest today is David Farno, Chief Growth Officer at WeWork. We met over an exchange on Twitter about what drives performance and about what assessment tools help drive team performance. And we continued that conversation over coffee one morning in New York. As Chief Growth Officer, Dave leads global real estate, design, construction, sales, marketing, and data initiatives with an emphasis on how technology is leveraged at every step of the way to ensure people are getting to do what they love. In our conversation, we talk about the role of architecture and the role of architecting software to help make the experience of work work and why that is important.
I think employees are the new customer, you know, and I think it's as simple as that. If you've got an engaged and fulfilled workforce, I think it's going to be very hard to not have happy customers.
We talk about Dave's magic superpowers.
Listening to books on Audible at 3x.
And we talk about what employees really need to focus on.
Understand what matters to you. You know, try very hard to understand yourself. You know, don't lie to yourself about who you are and who you think you are and what truly drives you. And then understand if you want to double down on your strengths or work on deficiencies, but figure out what matters to you and what drives you and pursue those things.
I know you're going to enjoy this episode. Enjoy. Dave, thank you for joining me on this edition of The Human Enterprise.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. And you know, this is a theme I care deeply about. So I'm excited to have the conversation.
Well, Dave, you know, not only have you helped build one of the companies that defines the very essence of the future of work, but you've also recently helped deliver a second young baby into this world. Firstly, congratulations.
Thanks so much. I'm getting very good at being a baby nurse. That's pretty much the extent of my value at this moment. My wife did all the real heavy lifting and whatever I can to make it easier on her.
Good. But I'm sure you'll have been occupied with imagining how to make the world a better place. So I just want to start off with, what is the future of work in which you would like your children to grow up in?
I'd like it to be stress-free. I'd like them to never work, at least in the sense of, you know, the sort of negative associations with work. I want their hobby to be their work. And I want the workplace to be devoid of sort of a bit of an extreme word, but suffering. You know, I think that there's these sort of like micro traumas that happen in the workplace consistently, be it an awkward exchange with a colleague, be it a bad interaction with a manager, being, you know, struggling and stressing about a comp conversation because you can't make your rent, but you don't want, like, That just, you know, those things are very taxing on people. And I think that to get people to a place where they can be their best selves, we have to figure out how to create an environment that at least minimizes a lot of those things. And I think it's very possible. I think it's actually a lot more possible than we might think it is.
And am I right in thinking you were originally trained as an architect?
Yeah. I've been in the building industry the bulk of my life, and studied architecture for 7 years and worked in architecture, and then throughout that whole time was fascinated by how technology could streamline things and make things better. So I had this sort of passion for technology that was applied to this very specific domain. And then over time, kind of what I realized about my interest in buildings was less so the buildings and more so their purpose, which is to, you know, create environments for people to do things inside of them. And too much of the conversation for me around the buildings was about the building. And I kind of said, look, the building doesn't matter. It's not, the building's not the end. It is a means. The end is what I'm in pursuit of, which is people living amazing lives anywhere. You know, ideally, most of the time they've got a roof over their head and that's the building part. But there's not enough of a discussion on, at least in the discipline of design and architecture, like how can the people interact better and sort of live better lives? And there's only so much the building can do, especially given the sort of contractual and business relationships that architects have and their kind of distance from the end user. But that's where a lot of my passion has grown, and WeWork really gave me an amazing venue to explore those ideas.
So as you think about, you know, obviously, you know, it's funny you should say that about the architecture, because simultaneously on, let's just say, the business side of things, I don't think enough thought is given to the physical kind of theater of the architecture as it relates to the office. But let's come back to sort of your perspective on, I suppose, the architecture providing a framework that can help drive certain behaviors and make people feel a certain way. How far can software then take over to create order and de-stress the world? How do you compartmentalize the role that the sort of architectural software can help?
Well, I mean, a lot of the emphasis on software, specifically architectural software, has just been to make the process more efficient. I don't really think it's changing the outcome that much, or let's call it the user experience. There's a lot of excitement and energy around what's being called prop tech, which are doing, you know, are trying to create technologies in the built environment. And some are focused on the end user experience, but at the end of the day, it's up to the company. Right. And that's one of the sort of challenges with B2B software is that you have to convince the sort of entity to, one, sort of buy into what you're selling, and then two, they have to deploy it or implement it in the way that you think is best for them to get those outcomes. And so then that just then results in, you know, what you've seen is lots of large enterprise bespoke engagements, and it doesn't end up really kind of looking anything like the original intent. And a lot of the focus is on streamlining, you know, things for the enterprise. And it kind of lacks that B2C feel because the consumer is not the customer. And so you always have this intermediary, and then a lot of this sort of enterprise technology is beholden to the person who's paying the bills, you know, at the end of the day. And so I think those are some things around the technology that could use, that have lots of room for innovation and disruption, frankly.
So maybe I totally misphrased that, although it gave me an opportunity to hear what you think about architectural software. So what I wanted to ask you about was, how do you architect solutions for humans, as it were, for employees, that help them de-stress their life through software? So it's a sort of, it's how do you think about tools that you can create to make the workplace work for people?
Gotcha. I even like that question better. So I think that it starts with customer centricity, and the customer in this case being the employee, and really being unrelenting about that, and understanding that the workplace is this emotional pressure cooker, and people come in with very unique, yet, in my opinion, sort of codifiable ways of being. And this is where some of my sort of research has led me down, you know, the various, whether they be called assessments, instruments, personality profiles, but these attempts to kind of codify let's call them work styles, right? Because I think we can change. But I do think that it's important to have an understanding of that baseline, right? Because I feel like to change, you're going from point A to point B. If I choose to ignore that there's a point A and I'm only in pursuit of a point B, I think that change becomes a little harder. It's not to say you can't do it. So that's why I really like these tools, and I've used them in practice. You know, over the last 24 months, we worked with a consultancy that sort of used an assessment as the underpinnings for coaching. And you know, the founder of that group, they're called Market Force, and Travis Carson is always telling me, look, it's not about the styles. The point is to make the styles irrelevant. And I completely agree with that. But being able to have that common language of the styles, and then to get people to use that language and talk through the various instruments that are then built off of that language, really expedite interaction, a positive interaction. And then the other thing they do is they make it kind of unpersonal, which I think is really good, because you kind of say, look, this person is not trying to hurt you. They're not trying, they're doing these things because it's just kind of the way they think it's the way to do it. It's not about trying to ruffle your feathers or offend you. And I think it helps people build empathy, because I think empathy is very hard, you know, because oftentimes we want to sort of approach things in the way that we would approach it. And so if I put myself as me in your shoes, well, that's a very different thing than me trying to understand being in your shoes as you. And so that's what I think a lot of these systems really enable when used that way. So they kind of help you explore yourself and give you kind of a framework for doing that. And then you can use that framework to try to understand other people. And I think a lot of those things, I think there's a lot of room for innovation with technology. And you know, a lot of those things I think are kind of like assessments and coaching and training and a little bit of an old school model. And I'm really excited to see where some of that can go and sort of flourish at scale.
So you talk around kind of the behavioral models. How about the value-based models? So some people talk around culture fit, some people talk around value fit. Have you used any of the tools that help people, it's the same point really, understand their values? Because it's very rare that if you ask someone, what are your sets of driving values in life, that they'd really have a coherent response. Have you gone into that space at all?
No, not an area I've researched or applied any tools on. I will say that at WeWork, kind of what we had going for us is that the mission was so present in everything that we did that you could just kind of assume that, you know, most people there were sort of subscribed to the company values. And if they weren't, they kind of sort of self-selected out. But it's an area to explore. I guess we'll take that one offline in another one of our coffee shop talks. I want to learn more about it.
But that's kind of interesting that, you know, I would clearly hold WeWork up as having a strong mission, a strong purpose, and a strong culture. Have you immortalized, crystallized that culture into a deck, a manifesto, so that when new people come in, that it's super clear what the culture is? Or are your rituals so strong within WeWork that it's just bloody obvious what the values are and the culture is?
I'd say it's a combination of both. I think the company has done a really good job at developing like an onboarding and a great day one and sort of an inculcation process. And then I think there are these sort of tent pole events that are sort of re-inculcations. And I think the company's done a really great job of continuing to sort of be clear on what they stand for and what matters to them. And so I think in that sense, the values are very present. And people sort of live them day in and day out. And it sort of happened, I would say it's very deliberate, but it was also not like an overt thing. It was just like, no, this is just the way companies should run. And I think now you're seeing more and more companies sort of bring in agencies and consultancies to figure out their why or, you know, what they stand for, because the workforce is demanding it. But WeWork was just that way from day one. It predates me. You know, I think Adam and Miguel just, this is kind of how they thought about the world.
But that automatically gives you something for the team to organize themselves around, especially, you know, back to your piece around developing a language through which you can understand other people's behaviors and what drives them. If there is a strong sense of culture, then there's already some alignment around what motivates people and how people should behave.
Yeah, I think that, you know, having a strong mission, you know, and not just the words, really living it, will sort of forgive the lack of maybe a lot of explicit detail around like values and things like that. Because people will just sort of buy into that mission and understand that understand it at the intent level, which actually I think then gives them a little bit of room to interpret and apply to themselves in what helps them achieve that intent and what is the intention of the organization, and to kind of put everything through that intention filter, but still giving people agency to do it in a way that's comfortable for them.
And so when you think sort of internally about how you're thinking about the organizational structure or around tools that will help drive the internal performance, what are your kind of key areas of focus?
It's been around how to help people understand each other better. And what are the things that ideally motivate someone, but also what are the things that they're just worried about, so that you can be empathetic and understand it. Yeah, I kind of buy into the DISC model at the sort of the original sort of 1920s version.
Yeah,
you know, maybe not as much. You know, so it's been commercialized in lots and lots and lots of different ways. But you know, I think if people can, you know, authentically self-identify with one of the quadrants, and you know, not because they have to, because they sort of embrace it and think that it makes sense. You know, I don't want them to feel forced into it. And then everyone can kind of understand that about each other. Then you can kind of understand like, what are those pressure points? You know, so, you know, someone doesn't get included in a meeting. You know, certain styles will process that in different ways. Some want to be there because they want the work. Some don't want to be there at all. Some want to be there just because they want to socialize, you know, and kind of understanding those things and giving people the benefit of the doubt instead of kind of going to those dark places that, you know, high stress environments can create, I think is really helpful because it helps people assume best intent. And I think that's pretty critical. So coming up with different processes and ways to talk through these things and sort of always push people to assume best intent, I think lowers a lot of that, you know, sort of just like agita in the environment that I think then makes things just shouldn't escalate. They escalate much quicker when that's there. And WeWork's, you know, a high growth place, and there's a lot of high growth companies. I think just the state of business is becoming much faster and much higher growth. And so the baseline pressure state, I think, is higher than ever before. And so the more we can understand those pressure points for people, the more we can help ease them, especially as leaders, and to sort of coach our leaders on how to do that and to help people grow. So again, so they can be that best version of themselves.
Because, I mean, one of the fundamental struggles, tension points around fast growth and large teams is around communication, isn't it? It's about that, a sort of transparency. Not everyone should be involved in everything. But B, it's about if you've got some core ideas, how do you communicate those across everyone when you're literally not going to be able to speak to them? And I was, I read at your recommendation, Aaron Dignan's book, Brave New Work. And I recall from that something he talked about, a team charter. And it, what you just said there, Dave, reminded me of the team charter, which is sort of like a declaration of, this is the way we're going to work. This is how we're going to interface with each other, and so on and so forth. Have you implemented any tools like that? It's not an employee handbook, is it? But it is a way to help people understand some of the rules of how you're interacting with each other.
No, I'd say we had at Case, the company I co-founded with Fed and Steve that WeWork ultimately acquired, I'd say we had a little bit of some of that. We were starting to have some of those things there. Like we were actually even creating a communication guideline on like this type of communication happens on Slack, this on text, this on email, because everyone's got a different assumption, right? Like, yeah, my wife expects a response from a text in negative 2 seconds, you know, versus a phone call, you know, it's like, and so I think everyone's got these different personal relationships with communication methodologies, and none are right or wrong, but they are again going to create these moments of agita because there's just different expectations. And so and that was one that was very successful in the sense that, okay, if you send an email, if someone takes more than a day to respond, then that's kind of not okay. But don't expect them to respond in 30 minutes. If you want that, send a text. If you expect them to respond within a few hours, use Slack. Because otherwise everyone just feels overwhelmed. And then this is where some of my more recent thinking on, you know, different styles process those things in different ways as well. And so I think the more, as the person engaging, if I can have an understanding of how a person likes to communicate, which mediums are more comfortable for them, so I know what I need to talk about, I know how they like to process it, then I can think about the whole picture on what the best place is to have that conversation and how fast I need to have it. And I think so the more we can sort of lay in compassion and empathy into the workplace, and look, it's inherently slower, but I think in the long term, it's faster, and putting in that work is worth it.
I mean, listening to you talk through that, it's like marketing 101, isn't it? It's like empathy with your end user. What's the message? What's the response? And what's the channel that you can elicit that response from? And
Well, I think employees are the new customer.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's as simple as that. If you've got an engaged and fulfilled workforce, I think it's going to be very hard to not have happy customers.
So that's a fascinating point, because I'm 100% on board with that. Does that belief, is that a Dave belief? Is that a WeWork belief? Does that belief come out in the kind of the spaces that you're creating at WeWork? The fact is that actually to develop great customer experience, you have to deliver great employee experience.
I don't want to speak for the company. It's definitely a Dave belief. I think that, you know, they would say that they 100% agree, but it's definitely something I feel strongly about.
So I'm interested in what sort of environment companies can be providing for their employees. And when it comes to learning and development and utilizing kind of on-demand training and or on-demand learning and things like that, what are the things that are interesting you that you think should be a fundamental building block of, you know, a good employee environment when it comes to giving access to new ways to learn and helping people develop themselves?
Yeah, my experience with this stuff is it's rarely a commitment from the company that prevents these things from happening. The companies are willing to invest in tons of subscription for on-demand learning. Companies are willing to pay for people to go to conferences. You know, it's actually when you get down into the trenches and the work that the sort of social pressure starts to kick in, where if you're sitting at your desk and you start to watch like a video on Lynda, well, what's your manager going to think? And I don't think we've gotten past those things yet. You know, and so I think we need, yeah, it's getting people to buy into a growth mindset and understanding as a manager. I think we've got like a plight in management, like middle management, let's call it. And this is not a new problem. I think this has kind of always been the case, is where we're sort of where the rubber meets the road is where that most resistance is. And be it deploying new technology, trying a new budgeting technique, deploying agile development, a new project management style. It's the people who actually have to deliver that either will make these things wildly successful or will sort of end them on the spot. Because the company can do things like take everyone offline for a quarter to go, you know, for a day, once a quarter to go do something. But it's really about that day-to-day use that I think really enables people to learn, engage with it, be excited by it, apply it. And so I think we've got to figure out a way to get managers to be coaches, essentially. You know, I think that, one of the things I was going to do was essentially create a coaching function. But then I started to realize that that wasn't going to do it, because that was not going to be scalable to, to hire 100 coaches. It's who are those people that are interacting every day with their teams that need to act like a coach and need to think that their responsibility is to be a coach and to help these people that are sort of choosing to work with them to work at their best. And so we've got to figure out how to get these folks that are, sort of progressed by probably being a great individual contributor and a domain expert that are now a people manager to realize that that is a discipline in and of itself and that they've got to help people discover their strengths or choose to build on their weaknesses. I kind of go back and forth on my opinions on that. But to help these people build their careers, so then ultimately the company will benefit. But it's a little bit of an indirect approach. If companies want to have these lasting relationships with the people that are, choosing to spend their careers there.
And how do you bridge the gap between middle management or whoever it is? It's probably a little bit of all of us. When it comes to, letting go on the training and feeling confident that actually their team should go off and do some real-time, online training. Have you been able to make progress in encouraging your teams to go off and do these courses? I mean, like, have you allocated Friday morning for learning or any other ways to help make it happen?
I mean, I would mandate them. And then my leadership team was fully bought in. And then they would use it. And I did do things like bring in external coaches for managers so that they could have a place to be heard that was somewhat external to the sort of chain of command, which then, in particular was something, again, the company we worked with is called MarketForce. But it has some ideas that overlap with DISC and sort of really using their language. And then getting them to sort of work through that language and, troubleshooting issues through the languages of styles and the various tools that they had. And, and a lot of these things have kind of instruments that work. And not every people interaction is this bespoke thing that needs to be treated and diagnosed. That, I kind of believe that a lot of these workplace problems sort of typologically start to cluster. And that is one of the great things about coaches is they've seen these situations over and over and over again. And they can say, okay, well, this one might be 10% different, but on that 90%, this is what I saw work in the past. Why don't you give this a shot? And so I think educating managers on how to do that real time would sort of help people work better together.
Yeah, I believe that strongly. I mean, for a while I've thought around the hardware of work and the software of work. And increasingly, I believe that there's a sort of a people element that sits in between, very much playing into the coaching mentoring space, where there's a sort of thinking about architecting those human interactions is a vital part to getting teams working. You can't just have great software solutions like Lynda or great hardware and architecture that WeWork might provide. But there is a sort of a structure that you also need to put in place around how to drive the interrelationships between people at work. And the inarticulate way that I describe that is that sort of people operating system.
Yeah, and it's key that as an organization, you understand that the implementation is going to take a minute. Right, and having the patience and sort of the foresight to know that these things will pay off, and that they'll take a minute and finding opportunities to do it. Right, I used to implement software, and so you would need the organization to say, okay, on this project, we understand that we will introduce some schedule slack or some budget slack because we can't expect it to be piloting new things, be it technology or processes, and operate at exactly the same way or better than we did before. Right? It's like long term it will, but more than likely project one won't. And don't be so quick to throw that out. Understand that you need a couple projects to figure out the kinks and see how it applies, you know, whatever that intervention may be to that environment, and a commitment to a long term. And I think that's kind of, you know, one of the things that we did well in implementing a lot of these things is we really bought in to the promise of what these things can be. And we saw early wins, which was very helpful and sort of helped drive optimism. But there was a commitment. And, you know, and then, you know, obviously if something doesn't work, know when to sort of change and iterate. But that commitment to the promise of it, and it paid off for us.
Dave, I know you've got some weeks out and you're reading an awful lot at the moment. Are there any books in particular that either from your recent kind of library or from your past that you have found particularly useful, stimulating, and informative?
Yeah, my go-to recommendation for everyone is Mindset by Carol Dweck.
Yes, great book.
I think that it is just critical. Like, I see it, and you can detect it in a second. And I also think, as much as I do think some things are biological and are traits, not states, I think mindset is absolutely a state, and you can change it. And if you look at someone like Sean Acor, I think is how you say his name, and some of the work he's done on positivity and happiness, and that you can change a mindset, and that to kind of come in to the workplace and thinking that kind of anything's possible, that might be the extreme of a growth mindset, versus just sort of assuming things can be done, or that, you know, oh, that person, they only know how to do this, that's it. I think those things are really debilitating, and people feel it. And especially as a leader, your teams seeing that you have a growth mindset, which then sort of extends to them, and you have a belief that they can grow, and you sort of want them to grow, and your belief is that if they grow, it'll be best for them, that I just think it makes everything so much better, and people connect with it because it no longer becomes about just like a work relationship. It becomes about an investment in the relationship and the person that can sort of transcend, you know, place or company or enterprise. And so I think a growth mindset is something that, you know, I personally believe everyone should try to achieve, try to have one. And I think about it in the way that I parent. I think about it in the way that I lead. I think the way that I manage, and giving people that psychological safety to try things and be okay with failing, and knowing that through failing is how they learn, and, you know, and ultimately achieving that growth mindset. So that's a book I just cannot recommend enough.
I totally agree. I love the guidance it gives you during parenting, as you kind of say. It's very rich. Wrapping up, I'm interested in your perspective on the future of work, especially as it relates to the kind of the abundance of technology, screen time, automation around us. What gives you hope and what excites you about the future of work?
That people are less willing to do work that they're not passionate about. I think that, you know, you go back 50 years, the relationship with work was just like, you just suck it up and you got to do it. Got to make that paycheck. It's just work. You know, my parents, you just work. Whatever it is, you take that work, and you be grateful that you have that work. I think that's helpful, and I appreciate that my parents had that mindset and they sort of instilled it in me early on. But I also think that we shouldn't give up so easily on pursuing something that we're incredibly passionate about. Because I just think so many more things will work then. And I'm very optimistic and excited that the generations now coming into the workplace are unrelenting when it comes to doing something that they're really, really passionate about, and enables them to be their authentic self. And I think a lot of things will work better as a result of that, because people will be happy doing the work that they're doing and will have very little tolerance to just not be happy, because their understanding life's too short to just go in and just work a job. And so I think that that's a, for me, something I'm excited to see happen in the future of work, whether it's technological, automated, you know, robotic. I think the humans, and you know, they're going to be involved in the workforce for a long time, are going to be much more deliberate about the things that matter to them, and much more, sort of unforgiving about pursuing the things that matter to them, which I think is great.
Well, that in itself is a kind of an exciting thought. I've got three, four final fast questions. Just think of a quick response to these. What's your most successful habit?
Listening to books on Audible at 3x.
What's the secret ingredient to your happiness?
A growth mindset.
What's your advice to the next generation?
Would it be cheating if I said a growth mindset again? I think understand what matters to you. You know, that try very hard to understand yourself. You know, don't lie to yourself about who you are and who you think you are and what truly drives you. And then understand if you want to double down on your strengths or work on deficiencies, but figure out what matters to you and what drives you and pursue those things.
And finally, what are those unmistakably human touches that make an enterprise great?
Empathy and compassion. And, you know, having those layered onto every decision you make. And that, you know, thinking about the micro interactions. Yeah, can I change the password on my computer or can I not? And what does that say about how much the enterprise trusts me? So I think thinking about the humans and not the resources.
What a great place to end. Dave, thanks. It's been great catching up with you. Thank you for joining me on this edition of The Human Enterprise.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Look forward to talking again soon.